Okay. This is introduction to Steve Howe. Steve is a very old friend. I've known him. It'll be 50 years next year. So scary thought. We met just as the band was going into AdVision when Yes were about to record Fragile. I got to know him much better on tour, and we had great time together in various parts of the world, including Japan, where we were both struggling desperately hard to find vegetarian food, which was, I would have assumed that it was a natural thing and it would be a big part of Japanese diet, but definitely hard to find restaurants that served it. In one occasion, we were in Kyoto and we'd been around, walked around the temples. It was brilliant. But in the hotel, we were trying to find vegetables. And in the end, we managed to make a meal by listing all the vegetables. And when we got the bill, it was for 12 different meals. It was a phenomenal bill. Anyway, we left that to Brian Lane to sort out, who's good at sorting out issues.
I love that story that you tell of him, which I just realised you probably can't say on this. Never mind.
Yes, probably best to pass that. You've known Steve, a long time, haven't you?
All my life.
Yes.
All my life I've known Steve. And you were saying that you think that we first met when I was 10, but I feel like I must have been younger than that because he sort of feels like someone I've known forever. And listening to the interview was so nice for me as well. It was sort of a combination of the fact that the things that you guys talk about obviously are really interesting, particularly like listening to how he comes up with ideas for music, but just listening to him talking as well was like listening to Yes music. It was sort of, incredibly familiar and homely, which was nice seeing as I can't come home for Christmas. Listening to you and Steve,
chat. Well, I remember taking you to a Yes concert when you were 10. And that's when I thought you also went to see Steve play in Asia, didn't you? So Steve was that legendary guitarist from Yes and Asia. And of course, doing the solo albums. And very briefly, which was before you were born, Steve Howe and Steve Hackett were in a band called GTR in a band together. So that was interesting. Anyway, John Anderson asked you if you liked the music of Yes, and you said yes. And then he asked you, what was your favorite band? And you said Backstreet Boys. You were only 10, so that was allowed.
And then didn't someone say like his daughter was going out with one of them?
Yeah.
And I was like, which one?
Yes, you were furious.
I don't think I'd mind it as long as it wasn't Nick.
Yes. That was probably about a year before you wouldn't have minded who it was, and they were no longer your favourite band.
Whereas Yes, I still love. So who's laughing now?
Yeah. Yes. Well, I remember the last time you probably saw Steve play in Asia was at the High Voltage concert in London, or was it on the cruise, or was he only playing with Yes on the cruise? I can't remember. Yeah, he would have only been playing with Yes. Yeah, did you like seeing bands play on the cruise and the concerts?
I loved it, and I loved seeing Steve as well, because I have a big obsession with Zuni jewellery, and I noticed on the cruise he was wearing this incredible Zuni inlay bolo tie, and I was like, oh, that's amazing, and I showed him all of my Zuni rings, and then apparently one of his grandchildren is called Zuni, which I was like, wow, that is really cool. That's a next step, loving Zuni jewellery.
Yes. Yeah.
I thought, can I get away with stealing that name?
Yes. Steve is very concerned about health food. And all the time I've known him, he has been. And he had a restaurant in Highgate, I think, called Brownies, which was a health food restaurant. No, health food shop. And I painted a bear in the style of a Japanese screen for it. Richard Bateman made the screen. So that was a lot of fun.
I think we need to put a picture of that in a link under this or something. Do you know where it is now?
Yeah, it's in the barn. I'll ask Bud if he can put a picture up on the talk.
Yeah, well, it'd be great to have some pictures of brownies as well. We should have asked Steve about that. I really love it when people who are just incredibly good at something just veer off and do something completely different. I was talking to Mum yesterday. She was saying how Karen Elson, the actress in the Indiana Jones films, has a textile company. And I was like, that is bizarre. But of course, people are human beings. And if they're clever and talented, it's probably not going to be just with one thing.
Well,
I would have liked to see the brownies. That sounds very interesting.
What can I say? This is Steve, really nice guy, very focused on healthy living and eating, and a guitar legend from Yes and Asia. And, well, in his own right, on his own, fantastic music he's made. Steve. Okay, we're recording.
Why then?
And when we're done, I'll send you a copy.
All right, you can do.
I thought it would be more fun just to chat rather than do this as an interview.
Sure. Yeah.
It's, what can I say? We've been doing this for a very long time.
talking a lot.
Yeah. Last time we chatted, we talked a little bit about where ideas come from, and I guess we talked about music and how that came about.
Yeah. Well, I've got an interesting story comes to mind because a song that John Davison and I have been working on contains like this sort of like one little tune in it that one day at the end of last year, I walked outside the porch, you know, this country place we got where the studio is with a guitar. And I just went, and something just came, you know, and it's formed a very, you know, integral, but not a big part of the tune that John and I are writing. But it's become a kind of backdrop occasionally to John, and I'm really pleased about that. But that to me was a moment when I didn't know what was going to come. You know, I mean, I just felt, you know, that I was... I needed to do this. I needed to go out and sing at the top of my voice outside the door, which is a weird sensation in itself. But it was almost like a saving grace. You know, it's like maybe it was a long drive and I got caught in traffic and, you know, I get here and like suddenly I'm thinking, oh my God, you know, what am I doing? And then suddenly you get this tune, you know, and it came. It didn't have any words. And that's what I liked. Often words don't come with the tune anymore. That used to happen a little more, but I'm not even bothered because I write lots of words and I write lots of tunes, so I can always put them together. But this time I didn't have any words, but I did have an idea, and it's great that, you know, when you write with other people, they pick up on something and they take it away and they develop it then. So you kind of lose it. It's like your baby, but it's gone. But it's nice when it comes back grown up into something else, you know, in some other way. I think that's what's great, so great about collaboration.
Do you find that ideas come without warning often?
Well, I wouldn't like to say often, but in a way, I could admit it. It does happen quite often because often I think, oh, I have a quick strum on the guitar, and then I'm looking for my voice recorder, which is a little Panasonic digital voice recorder, and I put everything on there, you know, so because it's unlike a phone, you don't have to open it and tell it, you know, oh, I haven't got the internet, all right, don't worry about that. You don't have to tell it anything, you just press a button and it records. So yeah, I store the ideas on there, and about what I was talking about, really. But where were we heading? We were just talking about.
Well, you telling me about how you just went out. Was that Curtis's studio?
No, I was here at my studio.
Oh, okay.
At that time, yeah, I was here in just before the new year, and I was on my own, and I just had a guitar, I walked out, bang. So I told that story. It's not as good the second time, but I think what my point was that, you know, whatever art is, it does often benefit from a transformation, you know, where an idea is taken further on, and that can happen in music quite easily. And then a third person coming along and say, oh, I think you should start like this, or why don't you have a middle eight like this, you know. So kind of, there is a sort of anything goes attitude, unless you're working completely on your own, like I was on my album Love Is. You know, I wanted to write the whole thing, get the whole thing going, keep steering it, you know. So that's a different personal experience as opposed to sort of collaborations. It's lucky that we get both. You know, in a way, I don't know, as an artist, you collaborate with your daughter Freya now, don't you? So in a way, you're getting a taste of that.
And I guess since the last Yes studio album, you got involved in that, which kind of took me by surprise. Because you hadn't much in the past.
Got involved in what?
In the Heaven and Earth album.
Oh, I see what you mean.
You were talking about the logo, how that might work. And I find it fascinating.
Talking
about it.
Hmm.
Because it doesn't feel like a brief. It feels like ideas that can flow in and flow out.
Yeah, I guess I've got that from working with other musicians and singers, you know, that there is something you can just put on the level and say, oh, look, what about this, you know. And in a way, sometimes you have to be brave, or sometimes you have to say it so you don't offend somebody. Like, I really like that, but I don't like that bit. it's a mixed bag. It really depends on how honest you want to be. Sometimes people really appreciate being honest, and they might say, oh yeah, well, I never thought that bit was very good. And I said, well yeah, maybe it isn't. Just as a, you know, sort of crude example of kind of the interplay. But getting involved in an album sleeve, I mean, in a way, like I've had been for years with Yes Production, one does a lot of things in a group that aren't like agreed on. They just fall your way, or it's shared experience. So as much as producing Yes as a team, where it says produced by Yes, you know, that meant it was a team, and it was. But helping on the album sleeve was also something everybody put a little bit in now and again, sometimes too much, or maybe a lot, or maybe, you know, others didn't do at all. But certainly going back to that sleeve, I mean, we loved it so much, you know, we thought that was a terrific sleeve. And you know, because it really was bright and clear and very very resilient to the times, you know. So it looked great. So well done.
I wasn't looking for that, but it was amusing for me because it was done on the basis of a mistake. I thought you'd given me the title Heaven and Earth, and in fact you gave me something entirely else. And it wasn't until we were talking with, I think it was actually on the cruise ship with Chris and everybody, and you were quizzing me about, okay, tell us about it. And I said, well, Heaven and Earth, I wanted something strange, like the quote from Hamlet, there are more things on heaven and earth than are dreamt of in your philosophy, blah, blah, blah. Mm-hmm. And that's when you said, but where did Heaven and Earth come from? And I said, isn't that the title you gave me? And you said no.
It was close, though, wasn't it?
I can't remember. Can
you? Okay, yeah. Yeah, my mind's sort of rushing back, trying to think, because there is a gremlin of memory of what you're talking about, you know, before that meeting where we were in that, wasn't it a hotel room or something?
Yes. Where that happened.
Yeah. So we were either in LA or we were somewhere. Anyway, that's fairly irrelevant. But yeah, I guess I had said something, and you know, interpret it. Yeah, we maybe we shouldn't go. I mean, titles are pretty precious things in my book, and we're not going to say what any of them might have been, because, you know, they're nice little things to have, titles. And so I must have had one. And so, yeah, how you get out of those things in the group situation, especially at that time, the way it was, you know, there were people that were in the band who were a bit of a hard sell as far as, you know, either, you know, getting on board with an idea like a title, you know, that I think it might have thrown more than yourself when I said, is that the title? they thought you and I had it together, that we, you know, we talked and we were, and suddenly it showed a huge crack in the communications. Well, that's good, you know.
I'm glad you stayed with it, because I liked it. I thought it worked with the painting. And
yes,
the quote.
Yeah, there was something there. There was definitely something there. It was a good idea. So then we had, of course, then we had a few album sleeves, you know, between then and there, with the live records mainly with you. And then, of course, Royal Affair, you know, which was the first one you'd ever had filmed. Was that true?
Oh, yeah, from beginning to end, including all the basic sketches. Yeah. That was an interesting experience. I enjoyed doing that.
I mean, the biggest cliche you can do, of course, is cram it all into 2 minutes, speed it up rapidly, like a Charlie Chaplin film. And you'll be going. And then it'll be finished.
That's how I do it. What are you talking about?
That's how fast you do it. Like that train. I always remember as a kid that famous film somebody made of a train journey. I mean, it would bore everybody to tears now. But I mean, this sort of some fast journey that they take you on the train. Maybe somebody cool made it, or they had a good dialogue or a poetry. Do you remember the one I'm talking about?
I think it was actually the Brighton to London route done in 1 minute, when it normally took just under an hour.
Yeah, I think you're right. But they did have films like that where they had talkovers by like John Benjamin, or, you know, somebody older than my parents, you know, were talking, reading poetry or something. But I always loved Alan Bennett, though. I always thought he did some great writing.
Yes. Have you heard from him recently?
I haven't read much about him recently, but, you know, he's one of those kind of guys I like a lot. I think he's cool, and, you know, he's written some great stuff, very funny, very, very witty, and very British, I suppose one could say. And I tune into a bit of that.
Yeah. You used to, I mean, one of the things I remember talking to you about on the boat was science, and you got me to listen to that book on tape about time, which I found fascinating. And you did an album on the greater scheme of things, which was that kind of subject matter, wasn't it?
Well, in a way, my album Time that I did originally released, it was on Warner Classics. And that Elvis Orchestra album I did. And on there, you know, because when you saw a picture of me with Time written, it was a bit like, you know, I knew that wasn't what I wanted. And all we got, we kind of, me and Paul Joyce, who was the collaborative arranger on that recording.
Yeah.
Basically, he found these images I talked about, which were all kind of scientific. So we plonked them in the right-hand corner as a kind of just a spacey idea, you know, and there were interesting dribs and drabs of scientific equipment, really, or symbols. And that was enough. And then when you saw the album, so you didn't think Time in the general sense, but hopefully it sowed this kind of subtle seed that we were talking about time in a very expensive sort of unknown sort of way, a sort of, you know, I played Vila Lobos as the opening piece, a piece of music that's usually sung like this. I won't go there. So it's a beautiful, you know, vocal lead.
Like playing song.
Well, like playing song, but, you know, Vila Lobos, he wrote this thing called, can't pronounce it properly because I can't pronounce anything foreign out of English properly, but Bacharanas Brasiliana, I think it was called. And this was a tribute to Bach by Milo Lobos, but he was Brazilian, so it was like Brazilian Bach, if you like. And it was a lovely, lovely piece. And not that I really did justice to it, or could have really, because it is such a special piece. But you try, you know, have a go. That's what I was doing on there, having a go. But in a way, what I was also doing was playing Vivaldi and Bach, but also my own compositions and some of Paul Joyce's. So we kind of did a collaborative orchestral project. But on that front, time, you know, time is that word. Like you say, there's quite a few books with time. I must have read at least four books where time was somewhere in the title. And it's one of those great mysteries of science, you know, keeps being like lauded in different sort of ways, you know, different interpretations. But I think today I was talking with a friend here, you know, about, because they were talking about how you never really lose your past. You know, you think of the past as something, okay, that's over, get me out of here, you know, the past. But hang on, but you're always within reach of it. It's always part of your makeup. It's always part of your today, you know. It's just part of the, it's the spearhead of the past is today. And it's fascinating, but how we make sense of it, certainly via Zoom in two different parts of the UK, I don't think it would be too challenging.
I had a very interesting conversation with my mother about, I don't know, 3 days ago, and she was talking about experience she had in art school. And it was the same art school I eventually went to 20-odd years later. And yeah, I found it fascinating that she remembered so much and so much detail about the place and the people and what she did.
Yeah.
And it was, weirdly, it was fresher. She portrayed it fresher than my own memory of the place.
Yeah.
It was sort of vague and woolly.
Yeah. Yeah, memory is a funny thing, because there's certain things one does remember, but there's other things one doesn't. And that's partly due to the fact that you forgot on purpose, you know, like things you didn't want to think about. But besides, and also the things that you lose every day, maybe in your sleep, you know, stuff just goes through. But I had an experience like that today where I was looking at a small lamp I bought, must have bought it about, you know, 35, 40 years ago. It's called it was a Gibson amp, and my story is about what it's called. So I'm looking at this Gibson amp, and we're doing a database of all this equipment. So I'm looking at it, I give it, it's only about this big, you know, it's a little practice amp, and I looked at it, and I said, well, it's a Gibson, you know, it's got Gibson written on it, Gibson. I said, I don't know what the model number is. And I turned around and said, but I think it's called a BR9. And I tell you, I looked inside it, it said BR9. And I laughed because I hadn't looked at this thing for about 30 years. It'd just been like standing there, you know, doing nothing. And there was a reference to a steel guitar called a BR9, that maybe it was a set with that guitar. You know, you bought the Hawaiian guitar and you bought this little amp. And they're both called BR9. But I mean, you know, that is a useless piece of information. It's no good knowing that it's a BR9. It doesn't help me at all. But the fact is, that's, you know, that's the kind of trivia that one keeps also. You know, you try and remember the important things in life, and then you find you can remember trivia.
Yes. The weird thing, the brain.
Pardon?
Yeah. Weird thing, the brain. But yeah. I was talking in general about musicians like yourself, who memorize everything rather than write it down, don't you?
What I do is, but as the music's being creative, I do write a chart, you know, which says like what the key is, you know, what the chords are, what the rough structure is. Of course, that will change as one's rehearsing or, you know, recording. But that chart is my only written thing I have. The rest of it, yeah. You know, I start playing and I think about, oh, let's play these chords like this, or let's have this punctuation, or, you know, let's go into this bit and arranging and writing. So that's great fun. And all I've really got is this idea, you know, that's sort of like, most probably every time I personally write a piece of music, that's the most important piece of music I've ever written, you know, because I'm bothering to use my time now to do it. So I have to think it's worth doing. And I guess I do that by thinking, wow, this could be, you know, this could be my masterpiece. You know, this might be something just, you know, so eclipsing other great compositions. But not that I bother to try any different. I just get an idea and follow it, you know, and that's what comes out, is what ends up. And usually then I'm liking it a lot. And then I need to step back from it and find out if it's really really okay, you know, to spread this around the world. And I was going to, like, say something now just off the top of my head, because you think I'm going to say one thing, but I'm going to say something else. It's going to be a little while, maybe after this is, between now and when this is broadcast, there's going to be the results of something that are going to be very important to a lot of people. And it's the result of the Champion of Champions snooker competition that I'm missing now on television. But anyway, you thought I was going somewhere, right? So Selby is playing Robertson, and it's a good match. But they've just started. So, you know, they're going to flap around for a few frames, and then it'll get like 4-3 or something, you know. And then,
Steve, you can about off your iPlayer anytime.
I kind of could. I can do that on the BBC because I've got iPlayer BBC, but I can't do it on ITV. I've got this thing on my computer where it really doesn't like cookies. Now, I can agree to those fundamental cookies at the bottom, you know, the one that says, oh, we do cookies, agree, or you can't do anything. So I press yes. But when it really wants to do something like, you know, get involved in higher technology, you know, I've got this wonderful cookie blocker. And then they say, oh, you can't do this because you've got, and I'm not turning it off. So yeah, I miss a bit of technology. I don't, you know, I'd love to know it better. But I can learn things that I need to learn, and then the rest of it passes me by.
I heard a fascinating story about snooker on TV when colour TVs were belatedly coming into England. Yes. They were looking for some sport that would show up well on colour TV.
Yeah.
And they picked on snooker.
Yeah, well, I mean, how could you watch it in black and white?
Absolutely couldn't, no.
Well, they did film it. They did show it in black and white. But I don't know how they talked about the balls. They have to say to the listeners, the watchers, the viewers, they have to say, he's going for the red, you know, he's going for a red now.
Yeah, or, you know, how could you, how does it work on radio? It doesn't, does it?
Snooker doesn't work on radio, no. But the other thing that was in black and white, I only read recently, and I think this is true because I saw it, was that in 1967, the Beatles first showed the Magical Mystery Tour, and it was at the cusp of the colour TV. And, you know, they could have shown it in colour, but apparently BBC showed it in black and white. And it died, you know, I mean, that day. It didn't resolve, you know, it didn't resonate properly because it wasn't in colour. And, you know, us hippies were supposed to see, you know, we were all colours, flowers, colours, stars, moons, you know.
Yeah.
And Magical Mystery Tour was in black and white. It was appalling.
You don't hear so much of it, do you?
Pardon?
You don't hear much about it.
What, the fact that it was in black and white?
No, about it at all. Everyone knows of it, but it's not high on the list of Beatles albums, is it?
Oh, more the Magical Mystery, I'm talking about the film.
Right.
Yeah, the film. Well, yeah, I mean, you know, it was what it was, but I mean, it was quite fun when you see it in colour. I mean, I've got it on, you know, one of their anthologies and things. Yeah, I mean, it's limited by how limited it was then. But when you think that the ideas were what made it work at all, you know, they were their ideas in collaboration with, you know, with the other things. But I mean, all that Strawberry Fields Forever films, you know, they were all very advanced for what they were because they broke every rule you could have. But after being in all those films and doing all that film work, you know, I think they were very photogenic and also, you know, interesting to see.
Can I ask you a question about improvising?
Yeah.
Is there a big difference between improvising and composing?
Not really. I mean, it depends, you know, what you're inventing, what you're writing, what you're composing. I mean, if you're writing a symphony, you're not really going to sit down and write a symphony like you might do some songs. In my experience, you know, the kind of music that most people write has to start by improvisation. You could call that inspiration, but that's kind of a word that really is overused and underdefined, because we don't really know what it is. But improvisation is when you don't know what you're going to play, but you just start playing kind of anything. And one of the great lessons in jazz is just play anything if you don't know what to do, because by doing that, you're going to find something. But the way music generally is constructed, like I described earlier about my recorder, you get ideas. They're not in any way fully formed, you know, like your sketches. And like, basically, but you as the artist know what to do with that. You know, one knows what to do with it. And that's what I've learned.
But sometimes...
Well, you mean I don't always know what to do with it?
No, I mean, I don't always know what to do with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Nor do I. I often don't. I mean, I might write something and discard it. You know, I'm not bothering with that. But at least one's got the choice. One's got to have I was going to call it a reservoir. I'd say a sort of well of ideas. Otherwise, you're only going to be able to play what you've just thought of playing. And the one thing isn't really enough, you know. So I look upon music as kind of ingredients, and you need bits of this. And if, you know, you don't need four chord sequences, you need one chord or two chord sequences, maybe, you know, you need a riff, you need some themes, you know, you need some kind of melodic stuff. But certainly going back to your original question, the improvisation is what allows me to, as I say, I might be recording ideas and get something, but what usually happens is I'm playing something and I think, oh, I kind of like that. I like the way those chords go. So, you know, I record it. So there's no point in recording 2 hours of solo jamming and then trying to listen to it and work out what's good. So you just record little things that you think. So that in a way is a capturing method, you know, like your sketchbook, you know, kind of captures the ideas. What happens to them after then is some of them will never see the light of day because they didn't catch your ear again or your eye again, or my ear, but your eye. So then that's what I think improvisation is. Music isn't complete without it. Even classical composers put in bits, you know, like do what you like here kind of thing, you know, trill the tune any way you like here. They gave them the freedom to, and that's written into a lot of classical music, not later, you know, maybe not sort of Beethoven so much, but the earlier guys, Purcell and Vivaldi, Bach, they also kind of like, well, you know, improvise here. It wasn't actually called improvisation. It had other names. I won't try and remember because I'm not great on musical terms because it's all done in my head. But yeah, improvisation, really interesting. It feels like we've only touched the very surface of it, because really when you say that word, you immediately think of jazz. You see, now jazz is a leader in music, because what's happening in there is that they take an improvisation to the nth degree. You know, it is improvisation. Now that doesn't mean that nobody knows what they're doing. They all know exactly what they're doing, and they all know exactly what the structure is. It's a vehicle.
They have parameters, don't they? They have a melody or something for a parameter.
That's right.
I was thinking often when I'm having an idea, I often work it out before I paint. But sometimes I start painting and I like something and I work on it and I don't have any clue where it'll go. But I have a kind of background track which I can follow. And I often want to avoid that, just to go into, as it were,
newer ground,
trodden path.
Yes,
but it's harder, it's slower, but it's fun.
Yeah Right, well, you know, all those things exist in jazz. That, you know, there is a structure, there is a sense of timing, you know, but there is this interplay that happens when one guy suddenly goes and somebody goes, oh, okay, I've got that. And then they play it as well, you know, so it's come out of the thin air, you know, the drum will go, So there's that talking to each other, which is really beautiful. And that's a great sign of real real improvisation. But I think it's like you said, in another way, you can't take it for granted. You can't sort of say, okay, well, with a lot of experience, of course, you can just get up and improvise. You know, I mean, that's okay. But I saw a guitarist, I'll have to keep his name secret, but he was doing a duo with another guitarist at Queen Elizabeth Hall, and they played together, but it was pretty good. And then one of them played and he was great, and then the other guy played and all he did was improvise. And you could tell he was doing that to the show. You know, he was like just taking it, like, in a way you could have said nowhere, because there was no structure to base this around. And that was a big risk to take, much too big. And even in like flamenco music, you know, like jazz, it's got themes, you know, they've got certain rhythms, there's certain cues they've got. And like Indian music with sitar, I saw Ravi Shankar's daughter play, you know, the proms. And that's a lot of impro. All got structure, but it's all got freedom. So it's funny how those things go like yin and yang. They kind of go hand in hand.
Yeah.
And the best of it is like that.
I can't think of an artistic, talking about a visual thing, that matches playing something you know, like a song that everyone loves. You know you're going to get a good response, yeah. And you played it 50 times that year, or maybe 20, I don't know. But I know from an audience point of view, it doesn't matter how many times. It still sounds fantastic.
Well, one of the reasons why that's possible is that the more times we play it on a tour in particular, in a way we really play it better. You know, in other words, we played it for the first week. It's got to a certain level. You know, there's levels of performance and you get to a certain level, certain confidence. Yeah. And then what is really honest about it is that, and I think most units of music would say, and it's the same for a solo show, you go on autopilot, you know, in other words, oh, the music's on, go on stage, play. It's like it's all happening for you, because in fact you're rehearsed. So a bit like a play, I suppose. Once you've done a play for a week or two, you haven't forgot, you know the words, you know what the expression is when you've got to turn around and say something. You don't say it in the wrong context. And that's the same with the music. So the music gets refined. We know what we're doing. It could be a great night, super night, fantastic night, or maybe occasionally an average night, but it'll still be a night. And that does allow you an opportunity. Of course, you know, if you do more than 6 weeks, I found after six weeks, you start asking yourself questions like, hang on, do I really want to play this for the seventh week? Is that, I love this piece, you know, maybe I wrote it, maybe I didn't, but I love it anyway, if I'm playing it on a tour. And I used to warn people about the over the 6 week mark, you know. So we have done sevens recently, before, you know, all this heaven craziness, and we got almost used to that, but sometimes it had to be like seven weekends, so it wasn't exactly 7 full weeks. So, and yeah, that's the point where, you know, drama and but not everybody starts to wonder if it's okay. can it get better after 6 weeks, you know, maybe 30-35 shows? There is a point at which, you know, I wouldn't say I don't want to play, but my tiredness and my, you know, sort of like the preoccupation in my life with it get just a bit too much, and 6 weeks is optimum. So hopefully,
I think with that degree of total knowledge of it, you have the opportunity to add the subtlest of hints and flavors. I can't see how it can do anything but get better.
Well, that's true. There might be a tipping point, you know, where it's got better. As I say, you know, 6 weeks, you know, it might get tired, it might get other things. But see, the other thing we're not talking about is singing. You know, singing is not just like pressing keys down or playing a guitar. You know, you can do that in all sorts of states of mind or health conditions. You know, if you've got a cold or something, you know, you can still do it. But for a singer, it's totally different. You know, he's got to have the confidence to go on and sing that stuff and be in the spotlight. It's really demanding, far more demanding than anything else, because it is like the top sound in the band, besides when one of us is soloing or something. But like when John is singing, John Davison's got to get ready, you know, and that's his dedication, you know, to get ready for that show in his own individual way that prepares him as best as possible. But you can't expect that just to go on indefinitely. It's like third month, okay. Because the voice is a delicate thing. So he actually does remarkably well by still singing well at the end of the tour.
When we were working with the Puccini Festival, with the opera, it was an interesting experience because they had to get the stuff off the stage every night because they couldn't do the same opera night after night because the singers had to have a rest.
Oh, because they had to have a rest, yeah.
Right, so if they did a two-week season, the opera we worked on would be on. Then it was off for a couple of days while they did, I don't know, Madame Butterfly or Turandot, something like that. Then we'd be back on again.
Yeah.
And that was to give the singers a rest. But it didn't give the stagehands a rest, of course.
The only other way they do that is they have an alternative lead singer, you know, or you know, which obviously, you know, a dep, if you like, we call it in the regular music business, but in the opera it's got a certain name, understudy, you know, and that's the only alternative that they've got, is to have somebody ready to stand in. And
performances though had 80 people on stage and a similar number in the orchestra pit.
Wow. What, of musicians and singers?
Sorry?
Of musicians and singers, you say the orchestra pit.
Yeah, it was huge, huge. And outdoors, of course, as well. So singers couldn't do anything but go full on.
Right, right. Wow, well, but opera's pretty heavy going. You know, I mean, I love all classical music dearly, and opera's my difficult area. Obviously I love when it's beautiful and sensitive and kind of quiet, but a lot of it's big and bold and bombastic. And although I have a very dear friend who loves opera, we don't talk about opera too much because I don't know anything about it. I've never found the sound, you know, connects with me in the same way as more, you know, sort of delicate, gentle music. So, but I do love the voice. The voice is the instrument of the world. You know, it's the most communicative, collective, recognizable sound that we can make, you know.
I gotta say, I do like it. There was a time when I thought it's quite hard work, but I've gone beyond that now. I just love it.
What voice of singing, you mean?
Opera, basically, yes.
Opera, yeah.
I guess it was, we listened to a lot when we were working there.
Mm.
But the power of those voices was extraordinary.
Mm.
You know, almost weapons grade.
Yeah.
And you know, the weirdest thing, when we were talking to all these singers who were doing unbelievable stuff, and some of them very well known, they only wanted to talk about John Anderson.
Oh, did they really? Okay, great.
Which was fascinating because, well, I guess it's what he does, things they don't do, and they do things he don't do, and they're fascinated.
Well, yeah, I was telling somebody recently how much I respect classical musicians because, I mean, you know, I play the guitar, I've been playing for like 60 years or something. But you know, classical musicians, I admire them very much because of what they have to do. You know, when you hear, like, although Ashkenazi's just retired, I mean, his piano playing would be astounding. You know, and there's world-class musicians of his calibre all over the place, but what they know, what they have under their fingers is beyond my imagination, how I could get there, you know, like a lute player like Thomas Danford, who's I think he's a French lutenist, and he plays like all this Dowland and all this other music. He plays a lot of very varied music too, and the most incredible technique. And I appreciate them so much. And then somebody said to me, "Yeah, but they don't really get what you do. People like you, they can't believe what you do." And I said, "Is that really true?" They said, "Yeah, I know some a lot of the classical musicians." He was telling me they don't get it. I mean, like you say, they admire John Anderson very much. They ought to. He's a great singer, but like basically from the standpoint of instrumentalists, it's nice that there is a bond of respect, because we have a mystery about. In fact, I played with a jazz guitarist who said, "You didn't know how I did what I did," and I was like, "But I don't get what you do one bit. I can't do any of that stuff." He said, "But I can't do any of your stuff." I said, "Well, you could if you tried." He said, "Well, I don't know how to." So there is a sort of mysterious gulf, and I suppose one of my things about playing the guitar is that I'm an all-round sort of guitar. I don't specialize in any one particular thing. I do several different things, and that allows me not to get kind of stuck in one and be expected to be just purely great at that particular thing. I kind of took an escape route where I said, well, if I can be pretty damn good on a lot of things, it's going to be interesting how I can spread that sort of Chet Atkins approach to the guitar, which was versatility, and he was very versatile, and I got inspired. So but really there is that, and I have touched on all sorts of different music, which has been part of my sort of inspirational period of just not really doing the same thing and yet doing yes through it, but still I did the trio, I've done solo tours, and I kind of juggle with these different projects, and I like it much because I can't be pinned down. Particularly, I think I don't want to be pinned down as a rock guitarist, because that's not what I am, strangely enough. I mean, it's part of what I am, and it's a very big part, but it's not an obligation I've got. I didn't sign a contract with the devil. You will play rock and roll. I'm completely free.
Just a thought. You said you respect how much effort John Davidson puts in preparing himself for a concert. But don't you do the same? I mean, you seem to take quite a long time before you go on stage, meditating and preparing.
Yes, the same. John and I have a similar, but in many ways dissimilar, but we have a time frame where we do focus on getting ourselves ready, and in whichever way he chooses and which way I choose. I mean, I've got a sort of a pattern, and it's really only 45 minutes, but I wouldn't mind an hour if everybody could keep out of my room for an hour. But an hour at 45, I just kind of I do relax, and I do a little relaxation, as I call it, and then a few little exercises which kind of motivate me to think that I'm ready, and then some singing. I do some scales and some singing. I learned from a lovely lady called Tona Debret in North London. She taught me really better how to sing in 1983. I'd just sung for like 13 years and didn't have a clue what I was doing. And suddenly she says, well, you're not doing bad, but you could do it better if you did this. So that's been a journey, a slow journey, never in a hurry to do that too much. But, you get somewhere after a while. And
how's your family? Change your subject.
Yeah, sure. Fortunately, they're all good. Yeah, they're all keeping their spirits up and working through the situation. And I don't think it's easy for anybody. Nobody's got it easy. In fact, in particular, people who have got to keep all the shit rolling all at the same time, they've not only got to think about others, but they've got to think about their children and their schooling, and the broader it gets, the more you can see. For some people, it's that little bit easier, and therefore that's why we want to help, if and when we can, and or as and when we can. But it's a shame that we can't do the things we used to do, but I feel wrong saying it, because everybody else feels the same way, that you know, we've stepped into another zone here. It's almost like one of those movies, you know, or The Prisoner, you know.
Yes, it's scary and it's costly to the world and to us too.
Yeah.
But on top of that, though, it's amazing. I see more of my family. I have enjoyed it, apart from the worry about other people, and I suppose worry about catching it and all the other worries that go with it. It's actually been a time to rethink and refocus. I don't know how I wandered into that.
Well, no, that's fine, you know, because in a way, this is the topic that, well, for the first 2 months, you couldn't have any conversation that didn't start like this. I think it's, we didn't start like this, but you get there because it is so prevalent and so relevant that, you know, just that gradual more and more realization of that this has touched so many things, you know, that were looked like they were out of the range of it, but nothing is out of the range of it, and the effect of it is tragic, and you know, it affects different age groups in different ways, I would think. You know, so I don't know. I don't know how to summarize or even, you know, sensibly talk about it. But like you say, there's great danger and there's great regrets and sadness and loss and all this going on, and it's hard to see how we keep going. But as parts of the population, like artists, have found, and what you were hinting at is that in a bigger way than it's looked like, the world has stopped turning. You know, not literally, but turning in the way that we knew it was, and that means we've got different time frame, you know, to work in. And I think I came off a stage the last time a year and 4 months ago. Well, I mean, that's not happened before in my life, that I've been off a stage for a year and a quarter, but been productive as well. I think it's a commitment to make sure that you are productive. I mean, there's no point in not being productive, so, but you obviously you have to get yourself in that geared up way to do that. I don't know, so I don't know how to take that forwards.
Well, the first month that happened was really when we were going to meet you guys in Florida for that mini tour and then go on the cruises. We were supposed to do a couple of art shows down in Florida. And when that got cancelled, it was like these fantastic vistas that one could fill however one liked. And then Freya came and gave me some projects and got me really busy. So I've been very busy.
Yeah. Well, I guess everybody's got to do what they can do. You know, if you can do something, get on and do it. You know, now's the time. Get your head down. But like you say, when you talk about what we were about to do, then you know, like most people had the perfect year set up. You know, they'd seen how 2019 was going, and they book their tours and book their plans, and you know, we, as you say, we had the cruise, we had some shows before the cruise, you know, we had a European tour, we had an American tour in the sketch, you know, which would have been finishing now, and none of it's happened at all. And it's fairly big that anybody can say that without sort of screaming or crying, you know. Yeah. Because it's such a massive consequence. And but there again, why should we complain more than anything else, other than musicians have been greatly neglected, you know, while they're doing, you know, furlong and all this for people, you know, there's a lot of musicians who deserve much more support. I know the Musicians Union and, you know, NCPS and everybody else is trying to help musicians to get through it, like, you know, increase the streaming royalties and things like that. You know, I mean, there are places where musicians have benefited, but also where we've been completely ripped off. And I guess, you know, the idea of free music might have started in 1967 with bootleg copies of your record, you know. But, you know, nobody can do very many things for free until they need some sort of, you know, income to put the bread on the table, you know. So, you know, I'm more concerned about a certain bracket of musicians who really must be struggling.
Same with artists.
Yeah, I bet. I can't imagine. It's so daunting to think, you know, the unforeseen circumstance, the unforeseen consequences of something so dreadful, you know. So, boy, there's so much talk about who did what and who, what, when, you know. And of course, you know, planes took it around the world, and before you knew it, nobody took any notice, including China at first, and then Britain didn't take enough notice, America, nobody took enough notice, and then suddenly, it's a pandemic, not an epidemic. And then we've got utter horror, you know, where, you know, we must have looked at China at first when they locked down a whole, 8 million people city and said, God, that couldn't happen here. And it did happen here, you know.
Yeah.
And it is happening. It's happening right now.
Yeah, I imagine all plans for next year up in the air.
It's shocking. It's a realization. We've gradually, you know, like gradually it's just gone like this, you know, and we've just been realistically starting to talk about, well, realistically, you know. So goodness knows.
We had,
because we have to have long-term plans. I mean, you know, anything has to, I mean, any business has to have long-term plans. Nobody's got any plans, let alone long-term plans, because we don't know what's going on. So it's so scary. We could be fried, you know, brains.
We thought we could do the autumn exhibition at Trading Boundaries. And we had an opening on Sunday, which was fairly constrained. You know, people couldn't, I think they had to limit the amount of time people had to come. But of course, by Sunday, by the opening day, we knew we had to close on Wednesday instead of being open for 2 months. It was barely 4 days. So it's. But it does feel like we have an opportunity to rethink how we want the world.
Well, that would be a fine thing if it didn't seem like in terrible ways that certain things are just going on regardless of the, you know, I can't believe that, well, I mean, we're stuck with, you know, the election, we're stuck with Brexit, but not things I'm going to mention, but just dreadful things going on in the world, as if we were back then when they still didn't have any reason to do it, any real reason. But, you know, awful things happen, but there's a pandemic, you know. I mean, you know, people are still being taken to court, you know, they're still being thrown in jail. You know, the world is still actually going on in a sort of disguised normality underneath the abnormality of lockdowns. It's, I think we better move on from that.
So, I didn't realize, I'm sorry, I'm kind of wandering back to something you said before. I didn't realize you wrote things down as well as recorded ideas.
Very, very structurally, yeah. I mean, it's very minimal as well. I mean, like, you know, a whole piece of music might be on one A4. You know, it might say F sharp minor, you know, B, I, F sharp minor. it's nothing really. I mean, to somebody, it doesn't tell anybody else what to do because they don't know what it is for. So in a way, it's only useful to me. And then give you an example, when we decided we were really going to play Relayer, we got on really well with Gates of Delirium and we had that one under the belt. But the same thing applies to that song. I had to make a chart where I could look at it and say, nobody else would know what it means, but I know what it meant. Like theme one, you know, but then theme one played differently. You know? And I'd have my notes, and sometimes I put them in a photocopy and blow them up so that they go from A4 to like this, so you can like have them there and look at them. They're kind of detailed notes, but they're only a reference because I can't play actually looking at it. You know, in other words, if I'm not sure where I am, I might glance over it and look, that's in the rehearsal, say. And the worst thing about that is if you end up on stage with one bit of paper that's got something on it, like a set of words that you just can't seem to remember. Because once it's there and you start looking at it, you'll always look at it. But if you take it away and go, no, I know it, I've practiced it, I can do this. Or you can have a teleprompter. You know, I mean, if you've got like thousands of words to sing, there's absolutely no excuse. There's no excuse why you wouldn't have a teleprompter, you know, or an iPad. Now it'd be an iPad, you know. And I think that's fairly good because, you know, that is a different mindset, you know. So, but for me, you know, I'm doing a few things on stage, and if I have notes, there's no really where to put them. I might look at something before. I mean, in fact, my tech used to come out and put a metronome in my ear, in my little pocket metronome. And he'd walk away, and then I'd go, you know, then I'd start at the right tempo. I mean, that's looking to get things. But going back to Relayer, these charts, you know, Sound Chaser was pretty big. And I thought for a while, oh, God, Sound Chaser's going to be this guy. Maybe, they're relying on me a lot here. I've got to, like, do this stuff, you know. And it started to come back, fortunately, because, you know, I was part of the team that wrote it. And basically, it's in my blood somewhere. So that's a good thing. So sometimes it's more important for it to really be embedded in you than have it on a bit of paper, because A, you could lose it. You don't want to keep looking at it. And C, you're free without, you know, without having to look at something and see it, you know, because it's in here. So yeah, I've got quite a good memory, mainly for things I wrote or I was part of the actual construction, or if it's been recorded, I can basically play it again. Yeah. I would think more or less anything I've recorded.
It's Gates of Delirium has to be, if not my favourite Yes track, one of them, one of a small number, and I really love it. And you and I have had this conversation, but I'll just mention it now.
Yeah.
I think it's a real shame you never called the album Gates of Delirium.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, it does sound good, doesn't it? I mean, it's really good. Yeah. Like Close to the Edge was called Close to the Edge. It had Siberian Couture and You and I, but it was still spearheaded by Close to the Edge, and that was a great thing to do. And we were really doing the same thing, the same format on Relay, as we'd done on Close to the Edge. So we could have very easily called it The Gates of Delirium, but you know, somebody had another idea, didn't they? And wanted to do it, like give it that separate name, Relay. Which had actually come from, I think I said this to you before, I know that word because it was a lot on, I think, side two of Topographic Oceans.
Yes, you said, yeah.
Yeah, the remembering. Relayer. It might be on a different side, I might be wrong, but it could be two.
So tell me this, because it was exciting, you making this announcement, that you haven't played Gates of Delirium on stage for 18 years.
Right. When we started Gates, it could have been 18 years because it was around 2002 that we'd started doing it. It's only 17, 18 years. But I thought you were going to say that, obviously, what I've said also on top of that is that Sound Chaser and To Be Over have not been played since 1978 or something, you know, when Patrick did his very last tour, 77, 78. So in fact, that music has had a complete like non-appearance on any Yes show ever since then. A few fragments may have been touched on, or you know, I did a guitar solo version. In fact, I recorded a whole version of To Be Over on my album Natural Timbre as a tribute to Yes, all on acoustic guitars. So I've been looking at that tune and loving it, and you know, but Sound Chaser hadn't been near that for a long time. But you know, prior to this cancellation, you know, I was getting very close to being able to play that whole piece fairly comfortably without some of the, you know, intricate details, but most of it was there. And what I had to do was be able to know what was coming next without really thinking about it, but just, oh, well, this leads here, that leads here. So if I'm here, I'm obviously going to go here now. That kind of a thinking strategy so that I could piece the bit together without looking at a bit of paper very much, which would sometimes just have notes like F, G, A flat, you know, something weird. You know, there's a few weird ones in Gates of Delirium where you're playing semitones. You just play, you know, lots of G, F, E flat, and then suddenly you're playing F sharp.
You're kind of verifying something I'd heard as a rumor, and this was years ago, well, not many, 5 or 6 years ago.
Yeah.
A tribute band, I think it was a French tribute band, were playing Gates of Delirium. And everyone was saying that it's such a shame, yes, don't play that, but maybe it's just too complex a piece of music. And you are saying it's complex, but not too complex.
Well, no, the Gates, you see, because that early millennium lineup had played Gates, you know, Alan and I played Gates, and, you know, we'd move forward, and you know, we were playing Gates, so that wasn't so unusual. Of course, it was a lot of work, you know, for Billy and John and Jeff to get it. And Jeff likes to go in different places, you know, with the keyboard player. He's, you know, he plays Tony's, Rick's, you know, Patrick's, and anybody else who's played keyboards with yes. So he's an all-rounder, you know, like he plays his own parts so well. So yeah. Basically, it was a pretty big challenge for those guys. I would hate to think if somebody said to me, okay, Steve, come, you know, learn this song called Sound Chaser, you know, as if somebody else, you know, and it wasn't at one of our pieces, I would be fairly scared. I might not want to do it, you know. I know I was once asked to play on a Pink Floyd album, orchestral or something, and I said to the guy, look, what's the point? You get Dave Gilmour, it'll, you know, sound like Pink Floyd, won't it? If that's what you want a guitarist for, don't ask me. I don't understand. I love Dave's work, but I couldn't play like that because, you know, well, I mean, you know, my versatility might be tempted to think that I might be able to, but he's got that under his belt, you know, like I have with, you know, Yours Is No Disgrace or something.
I guess it would be, I can understand you not particularly being enthusiastic to play on a Pink Floyd album playing his stuff, but you might have, I mean, you did play on a Queen album playing your own stuff.
I mean that's easy. A new song nobody in the world's heard of, and they say to you, play guitar on this, you know, and that's what I did. So, but they knew, they wanted me to improvise. There's an example. I mean, I just walked in the door, you know, an hour later I've got a guitar and I'm playing on a Queen record. I didn't know that was going to happen. So that, you could call that pure improvisation. And they did actually want me to improvise. In other words, Brian May had set up all the pieces and they just wanted something else, you know. So that was a great opportunity to pull it out of the bag.
I've got to say, I'm a big fan of Queen.
Aren't they great? Yeah. I mean, I can watch them kind of endlessly. I could keep seeing them. And you know, I really know that, especially since the short period of time that I was there in that studio. Well, we went to dinner, we went back to the studio. Of course, I ran into Brian several times, but but that time with Freddie was very special. We were at studios together often, you know, we saw each other lots of times. But, you know, he was very engaging and great fun. They took us out to dinner, took me out to dinner and went back and heard the guitar and, you know, edited it around until we liked it. And that was it. So that was a surprise. How did we get? Oh, yeah, because you're talking about you like Queen. Yeah, I mean, I was at the, you know, Freddie Mercury tribute concert, you know, in wherever it was, Wembley Arena. I was one of the guys in the seat up the side, and I loved being there. I almost, Brian thought he would have liked to have invited me to do something with them, but there were so many guests. I think Roger had invited about six people. So Brian was kind of trying to cram in like he did Tony Iommi. Can get Tony in on this then? Oh yeah, fine, Tony, yeah. So, but it was a wonderful concert and, you know, great voice. But I particularly do love that album. You know, it has such a great strength about it. And, you know, I'm Going Slightly Mad. So many of the other songs, yeah, I Can't Live Without You. I mean, that's incredibly astute, you know, the way Freddie pulled that lyric together. But what they were was a great, you know, such a great team, you know. And I think it shows all the time. When you watch them, what you can see is, yeah, I mean, Freddie's great, you know. So is Brian and Roger and the bass player. They're all really great. But the way they work together is they give each other everything, all the space they need, you know. And it was a lovely sound.
I had two experiences which I thought were very weird. One of them was when you were playing in Vancouver. We have a few more minutes. Is that okay, Steve?
Yeah, sure.
5 more minutes. You were in the recording in Vancouver. Can you remember?
Yeah, I can. Yeah, it was. I mentioned him earlier, didn't I? A producer. Yeah.
Yes. Well, I was waiting in the car, a hire car, outside the studio, and I had some piece of music on. It was electronic.
Mm-hmm.
And I was listening to it, and there's a bunch of kids waiting to see you guys, and they recognized me and came over. And one of them got really angry that I wasn't listening to Yes. I was listening to something else. And I said, you can't imagine that Yes never listened to any other music, can you? Anyway.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. I did something else. I picked up somebody, and I think they were going to do an interview, and I picked them up at the station, drove them back to my studio, and in the car, because Freya had all the Queen albums, she just loved them.
Yes.
And you know how it is, you get in the car, you don't think what's in the...
Oh, the cassette, you put it on and it plays. It just plays when you turn on, yes.
Yeah, and this guy said, you're listening to Queen?
Yes.
Steve Howe. And he wouldn't believe you were on it, so I showed him your squiggly bits.
Oh, yes, yes. Oh, how funny. Oh, no, it's Steve Howe, the guy from Yes, in Queen, yeah, with Queen. What a lovely moment that was. Yeah, I mean, I did love Montreux. My wife and I had a pretty good time there in the 70s. It was a fantastic time in the 70s. And we had half a floor on a in a hotel and rented a few houses as well. So it was a lovely, lovely place, full of memories. Yeah.
Was the Pink Floyd album you mentioned, was that the Pete Smith one?
It might have been, because Dave Palmer, as he was then, he was the arranger. D. Palmer, he is now. He was the arranger, and he had something to do with Pete Smith. Yeah.
There was one where. Oh, Youth and Jazz, Jazz Coleman.
Oh yes, I did a session for him. Didn't be connected with you. Something you were doing. I can't remember what that was now.
I did the cover for one with Youth and Jazz. Producing and arranging.
I did one session with each of them, and they were totally different to work with, utterly different, but it was great fun.
Yeah.
I've forgotten about that.
I actually like that album.
I don't think I've ever heard it. I mean, not from Yonks. Oh.
It had two titles. It was originally called Us and Them, and then it was called Pink Floyd Symphonic or something like that.
What, did it have something to do with jazz and youth?
Yeah. It was put out on Philip Glass's record label.
Well, I don't think it's the same story as when, as he was then, David Palmer asked me to play guitar on a symphonic, straight symphonic record.
Has it? No.
No, it was earlier. It was earlier then. But I remember those guys. Yeah, I did a session with each of them. And I just kind of went in and got a guitar, tune it up, what's the song, play it. And then the next thing, I was in with the other guy. It's great. I love that. Yeah, it's working with Trevor Horn.
You worked with them when they were doing the music for that computer game that we were working on.
Right, that was what it was. That's right, that's right. Yeah.
I thought he was an interesting producer, both of them, in different ways. Yeah.
I like the challenge of working with producers. It's really good. I mean, it's fairly transparent, really, because, you know, this is either working or it isn't working. Or it was working, but now it isn't working. Or, like, can you do it again? And then can you do it again and again and again and again, producer? You know, I've had the experience of working with many, but when I was very young, I showed up, like, off a bus to some session, and they said, okay, here's the music. And I said, well, I've come all this way and I don't read music. I said, oh God, we won't be able to play this. So like, I said, well, like, give me a chance. I mean, play it. You know, what is it? You know, let me hear it. And, you know, I got something down on it and I learned the tune. But, you know, I didn't learn it by their methods. So I've always been resilient to the the risks involved in not knowing really what somebody wants. But it's always better when somebody knows what they want.
I do remember talking to them, Youth and Jazz, afterwards, and they were astounded how quickly you memorize stuff.
Right. It's just, you know.
Just well, the way, you get for granted, they didn't. Well, we have just passed the hour mark, Steve.
Okay, then. So we'll sign off.
Yeah. I'm so grateful for you doing this.
Oh, it's been fun, you know, just hanging in. And it's like a hang-in. Like you say, it's your meeting room. It's nice. Well, yeah. See what you do with it. And you, if you want to give me a copy, that's fine.
Yes. When I finish it, it makes a recording. And I'll send you the file. It'll be about 900 megabytes.
Okay.
I'm going to just switch off the recording.
Yes.
Talk to you for 2 minutes, okay?
Sure.
I can...